Welcome to Project Psychology, brought to you by the Oxford University Psychology Society. I'm your host, Junior Crowford, the president of the society, and an undergraduate reading experiential psychology at Wadham College, Oxford. The aim of Project Psychology is to encourage more discussion surrounding the science of human behaviour. Episodes will consist of interviews with special guests who are experts within their field, who will join me weekly to share and discuss their unique insights within psychology and other related sciences. Hope you enjoy. Today, it's great to welcome Stuart Ritchie to the podcast. Stuart completed his PhD in psychology at the University of Edinburgh in 2014 and is currently a lecturer at the Social, Genetic and Developmental Psychiatry Centre in King's College, London. Stuart's research focuses on the development of cognitive abilities with a key interest in the psychology of intelligence. Stuart, thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me today.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so I just kind of wanted to start by defining key terms within intelligence because I think it's definitely one of the more misunderstood parts of psychology. So like, what do psychologists actually mean when they talk about intelligence?
Well, that's a very good question. There's a few different ways of looking at that. There's a quote from, there's a psychologist who has the great name of Edwin Boring from the start of the 20th century. And he had this quote, which when you first hear it, sounds completely useless and like tautological and doesn't make any sense. But actually, it's the key to understanding what psychologists really mean when they talk about intelligence. And the quote is, intelligence is what the tests test, right? So it's when you give someone an intelligence test, the score on the test is what psychologists consider to be intelligence. Now, that seems to be really, like, that seems to be really unhelpful when what people want to know is, like, is intelligence some capacity of the brain or capacity to learn or something like that? That's what people really want to hear. But actually, in psychology studies, it's just what the test tests. It's just your score on a test. And that's really the only useful way to think about it, because if you get bogged down in trying to define the concept and define exactly what it is, you make very little progress, empirically and actually, you know, you can get bogged down in kind of theoretical debates rather than just saying, well, we have these tests. They seem to predict some stuff. And we can talk about that, you know, the specifics of how they predict stuff. And they're kind of useful for that reason. We don't need to read too much into them, that they're like defining some, you know, archetypal element of humanity's psychological power. We don't need to read any of that stuff into it. We can just say the scores on the tests are what we're interested in. And then I think that stops us from getting too theoretically bogged down, but it also stops us from reading too much into them, right? If it is just what is people's score on the test, then that doesn't imply anything about how much that score might be changed, might differ in other circumstances. So I think that's a really useful way for lots of reasons to think about it. Now, the popular definition of intelligence, like if you look up the dictionary or whatever, is something like how quickly people catch on with stuff, how quickly people learn stuff, how much they know about the world. Or how much they know about a specific topic. It may well be that what the test test is overlapping with that to some extent, but I don't think that we need to really like pin that down. And the classic analogy that's often given is for this from a sort of philosophy of science perspective is temperature, right? We were able to measure temperature and make useful predictions with it and do useful things with it for hundreds of years before we could, you know, with mercury and with all various other methods, before we could define exactly what it is, which is, you know, the kinetic theory of gases, the movement of molecules and so on. Sure. We had no idea how all that stuff. So we couldn't actually give like a rigorous scientific definition of it before it was, for a long time until after many decades but we were still able to make useful predictions with it. So I think that's the kind of analogy that I would think of, is that even if we don't have a perfect definition of it, I think getting wrapped up in defining exactly what the definition is kind of a useless kind of fool's errand.
Sure. So perhaps a better question is, what do IQ tests test?
Well, yeah, that's another like long answer, because of course a full IQ test will involve lots and lots of cognitive tests. So they'll involve a whole battery of tests, starting with things like vocabulary, definitions, similarities between words, you know, analogies. There'll be nonverbal reasoning tests. So like those kind of puzzle things that you've probably seen. Raven's Matrices, sure, yeah, type things, where you're like trying to guess the missing part of the puzzle. Speed tests, where you're like having to check things off, you know, within a time limit. Memory tests are often included as well. So there's a whole bunch of things. And the kind of standard classic finding from the cognitive literature on this is that people who are good at one type of test, that is, you know, we're talking individual differences, so we're comparing people's abilities, right? We're comparing, yeah, you know, one person to another. We take a big sample of people. People who tend to be good at one type of those cognitive tests tend to be good at every other one on average.
Right. So this is G, right?
This is the classic finding of the general factor of intelligence, or G, which is that if you tend to be, you know, above average at a Raven's Matrices test, like a non-verbal reasoning test, you also tend to be above average on a vocabulary test. You also tend to be above average on a speed test, and so on. Now, this doesn't mean that there's only one thing that we measure that intelligence tests are measuring. It's G, and that's all we're interested in. It's just that about 40 or 50% of the variation across all the different intelligence tests is explained by this one thing, G, it seems. But then there's also lots of other specific abilities, right? So you can be anywhere on the G spectrum, on the general intelligence spectrum, but maybe you've got a specific, you know, ability in, maybe your speed is particularly good, or your memory is particularly bad, or your spatial abilities, which is, you know, like 3D rotation of things, is really good. You know, so there's lots of variation at different levels. So there's variation at the level of like the general ability, which is your overall ability that seems to relate to all different tests. Then there's variation at the level of broader abilities, like, you know, verbal abilities, non-verbal abilities. And then there's variation at the level of specific tests as well. Maybe you're just good at specific tests and so on. So it's much more complicated than just saying there's one thing. But it is also interesting to see that there is that one thing that captures quite a lot of the variation.
40% of the variation. That's a very huge amount, right?
Yeah, I mean,
like, there's nothing else that's near that much.
Yeah, I think you could, and it's like some people see this and they're like, "Wow, that's really exciting!" There's something that explains all that. And some other people are like, "Well, what do you expect? They're all tests for like positive." I think I'm somewhere like closer towards the end of, well, it's quite an interesting finding, because you could imagine a world where the brain had totally different circuits and systems and networks for different cognitive tasks, and people would, you know, these would decouple to a great extent, but they don't, and it seems like people's brains, you know, might be, for whatever reason, and by the way, the debate over the general factor is still going, like what actually is, sure, causing it in the brain, and why it would be the case that these tests are possibly correlated together. It seems like, you know, that's an interesting thing to try and work out why that is, rather than just saying, oh, well, we would expect these to correlate positively together, so it's not actually interesting. Although I do kind of see that argument, like you do have to consider all the possible reasons for why these things correlate.
So in terms of like specific factors that impact education, not education, intelligence, so there's sort of two ways to think about it. So like the environmental impacts, and then more for genetic or biological impacts. So like starting with the environmental impacts, I think years of education is often a cited facilitating factor in intelligence. Is that something that you've researched?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the first things you find out about the sort of correlates of intelligence is that people who do better on IQ tests, like we've discussed, tend to do better in school. And that's no real surprise, because, you know, academic stuff seems to be quite strongly related to what's on the IQ test and so on. But you can make a pretty decent prediction of how someone's going to do in their school grades, you know, even prospectively. So like waiting for years in between, from their performance on an IQ test, at least, you know, at the group level, you can place people, you know, sort of where, in a sort of prediction way. So IQ, one interpretation of this is that your performance on an IQ test is causing you to do well in school, right? Your intelligence, how smart you are is causing you to do well in school. And I don't doubt that that's true. I think that's you know, I think we'd, yeah, all agree that's the case. However, there's now lots of evidence, and we summarized it all in a meta-analysis that we published a couple of years ago, me and my colleague Elliot Tucker-Drobb, in a paper in Psychological Science, the journal. We summarized the evidence that it's not just that intelligence causes education, it's that the education causes or has effects on intelligence too. That is, there are sort of reciprocal effects where Sure, people who are smarter stay in school for longer. But also, there's evidence from natural experiments where people are forced to stay in school for longer, like by a new government reform where like the number of compulsory school years is extended. And some people who would otherwise have left are thus forced to stay in school for an extra year or an extra 2 years or whatever it is. Their intelligence goes up. It's positively impacted by education. You know, a few IQ points per additional year. Now, there's lots of questions that raises, which is like, if we just kept people in school forever, would their IQ just keep going up? And I think probably that's not true. I think there's probably like a plateau where you know it will have an effect and then kind of peter out. But no one's really, and there's like a couple of people have looked into that, but it's not really definitive. We don't really know what the answer to that question is.
Right. It's kind of a hard thing to study, perhaps. Like,
right, exactly. Because it's rare enough to find a natural experiment where, you know, you've got IQ tests, you've got a large sample of people, you've got the government changing. I mean, what, you know, the kind of paradigm example is what happened in Norway, and this is in the 1960s. There's lots of studies from lots of different years, but one of the kind of most rigorous ones is Norway in the 1960s. They increased the school leaving age, and they did it. The really interesting thing is that they did it essentially randomly across the country. So the paper goes to great lengths to explain how this was not done on the basis of, like, you know, the richer places got the reform first, or the poorer places got it first, or whatever. It happened fairly like at random across the country. And then in Norway, all the men do an IQ test when they do their military service. So there's compulsory military service. You have to do a year, I think, at least. And then you do an IQ test. Everyone does an IQ test when they join that. So they had this great natural experiment where you could compare the people who had been forced to stay in school for longer and those who hadn't on this IQ test that they all did. And it was all the same test and so on. So a really nice natural experiment. And they showed positive impacts of that extra year of education, or I think in some cases 2 years of education, on the IQ test. So really, really nice. But as you say, it's extremely rare to get that kind of data and really difficult to study. And then to study it in even more depth about, like, you know, the specific IQ tests are being impacted, the specific you know, how long the impact can go on for, and so on, is very, very tricky. Certainly from our meta-analysis, if you look across all the evidence, it does seem like the impacts of intelligence intelligence do last a long time. That is, you had people who were tested in old age who had had their educational increases in, you know, at the years we normally are in education, so quite when they're quite young, and they were still performing better on IQ tests than people who hadn't had an extra year of education. So it does seem like these are long-lasting effects. That's what we could tell from a meta-analysis. But there's lots more work to be done there. Really, just, you know, pinning down the right samples to analyze to really understand that. And of course, then you have to say, what is it about school? What is it about education that's causing the increase? And I do think it's I think you can make a causal claim from those natural experiments. So what is it that's causing people to become smarter? And we don't know. There aren't enough in-depth, you know, experiments yet. I think there's some guesses.
Yeah. Do you have any guesses, or are you willing to stake out any guesses here?
I think, so there's some that are like non-interesting, which are more like sort of teaching to the test type things, where it's like you get better at doing IQ tests because you're more used to sitting down and concentrating on a bit of paper and doing a test, and that's just what you learn in school. Like, you learn that sort of ability, and that's less interesting. But there's also, you know, other things about increasing people's motivation to perform tests, which is like, you know, somewhere in the middle. And then there's even higher up than that, there's like, maybe school improves people's ability to think in abstract ways, and that helps them perform on the IQ test. We just don't know. Like, there's just, you know.
I'm surprised there hasn't been much research on that. I thought that would be the main interesting thing about like education, because there's also like the effect of quality of school. Perhaps you can speak to this. So I think intuitively people think the better school you go to, the higher your intelligence would be, like in terms of like perhaps private schools compared to state schools. Is this the case?
I should say, all the stuff that I've talked about is quantity of education. Right?
Sure.
So it's years of schooling rather than quality. And there's comparatively less. And you say, you know, you'd think this would be really interesting. I mean, well, it is to me. I've done loads of studies on this, but I don't know why it's not been so interesting to kind of the field in general. And I think probably because the samples are quite hard to come by, especially sort of natural experiments, like the one I've been discussing. But Quality of education. Yeah, I mean, the problem with that, you know, as you were just hinting at there, is that schools, some schools are selective, right? So they select on the basis of basically an IQ test or, you know, educational results and so on. So when you see that, private schools might have a difference compared to state ones, it might be just because they've selected people who have, you know, scored better or done better in education up to that point. So it's not that the schools are having an effect; it's that they've heavily selected people. And certainly, I think that's what some of my colleagues, like Robert Plowman, I think, would say in his data analyses by Margherita Malenkini and Kylie Rimfeld and people like that have seemed to show that the differences that you observe between the schools is mainly due to selection rather than any effect of the schooling.
Yeah.
And I think those guys and I kind of disagree on maybe how much of an impact education can have, but I think we're kind of having, or at least if you read our papers, you would think that we were kind of disagreeing, but I think maybe we're just talking about two different things. They're talking about quality and I'm talking about quantity. And I think they're slightly different sides of the, slightly different sure. things.
But parents are truly like worried about which school they send their child into. And if it isn't actually the case that it has this much effect on educational attainment, then perhaps they should focus on other matters, no?
Yeah, I don't think just scoring well on educational attainment or, God forbid, IQ tests is the only thing you should be thinking of, and you should be thinking of all sorts of other stuff. But it's a bit like people talk about this with music lessons, right? They're like, well, the evidence shows that music lessons don't impact my kids' IQ. Well, why should I be sending them to music lessons then? Like, well, no, that's not the point. You know, there's a little bit more to it than that. Music lessons are good inherently. And so there might be some things about some aspects of schools that are good anyway, even if they don't improve people's education. So that's one thing. But also, there might be bad things about schools that purportedly increase kids' education. And so you need to think about things in a more a broader way, I think, rather than just focusing on one outcome. But I the evidence on social mobility is also what people think about when they think about schooling differences. And as far as I'm aware, how we used to have in the UK, we had grammar schools, which were the heavily selective ones, versus secondary moderns, which were, and this, you know, a lot of the responsibility for that system that we used to have, which we don't have anymore. I mean, there are still some grammar schools, but you know, the whole system doesn't work like that anymore. The responsibility for that goes to IQ researchers back in the early 20th century or the mid 20th century, who were advising the government that you should have a system where kids who are smart, who get selected and sent to grammar schools, and kids who score less well on the test should go to something like a secondary modern or a sort of more vocational education after that. And the kind of idea that those guys had, which, you know, in theory, the people like Sir Godfrey Thompson, who was the Scottish kind of educational reformer, he wrote that, you know, not a single penny less should be spent on one kid's education than another. You know, no matter what their score on an IQ test is or how well they do, everyone should get the education that they deserve or that they would benefit most from. And you should spend the same amount of money on every single kid. But of course, in practice, when they put the system in after the 1944 Butler Education Act, a lot more money went on the grammar schools and the secondary moderns, where the kids who didn't score so well on the 11 plus IQ test, the secondary moderns were pretty grim and pretty miserable, and kids didn't get very good education there. So in practice, the nice system that these psychologists had thought up actually ended up not working so well. And in fact, the evidence on social mobility is that, you know, any increases from people who went to the grammar schools are kind of cancelled out by people who went to the secondary moderns and didn't do so well. So
the net effect is like lower.
The net effect is sort of like, it didn't have this wonderful thing where, you know, these guys were, what they were thinking of was that kids from poorer backgrounds who normally would only get anywhere if their parents knew people or, were able to like use contacts or whatever. And that was obviously much less of a thing when you were from a lower socioeconomic bracket. The idea was that they would be selected by, you know, they're smart, and so they did well on the IQ test, which is a much more objective way of getting them into a grammar school, and then they would be rocket boosted into, you know, social mobility by the grammar schools. And that does seem to happen to some extent, but unfortunately, it's also the case that, you know, people are kind of held back by going to the the secondary modern schools, at least in the evidence that was available, you know, when I last reviewed it, which was a few years ago, in the UK. I should say, though, that there is evidence from the US that for something similar happening, which is that if you start using IQ type tests, basically like objective tests rather than subjective, like teacher ratings or parental pushiness or whatever, you do actually get a higher proportion of poorer kids and also kids from ethnic minority backgrounds in this kind of gifted and talented education program. There's at least one study that shows that. So, you know, if you just rely on teachers, then teachers can be biased in all sorts of ways. Teachers can say, well, you know, I'll just maybe, and sure. Unconsciously, yeah. They can say, well, you know, this white kid's doing really well, I'll send him. You know, and that might not be the case so much for kids of ethnic minorities or poor kids. Right. Using the objective test seemed in that study to improve the access to gifted and talented stuff. You know, it's a kind of a US thing to have a gifted and talented program. We kind of have some similar things in the UK, I think, but it's less of a thing. But, you know, that's at least, you know, some, it's like analogous to what those guys in education were wanting to do in Britain, was improve access to education for people who wouldn't otherwise have got it. In practice, that doesn't always work.
So why doesn't it work? So my intuition would be because of the resources would go towards the grammar schools and generally like teacher quality of teachers perhaps are more driven towards these grammar schools. Is that basically why? Like,
yeah. That's my reading of it, that the secondary moderns were like crumbling buildings and nobody wanted to go and teach there. And, you know, there wasn't a kind of rigorous curriculum to the same extent that there was for the grammar schools. And that's why the system became extremely unpopular. People who failed, quote unquote, the 11 plus, kind of carry that around with them for their life because they were like, felt like they were kind of being rejected by the system right at the very start. So it's not a great system to have. And there are likely much better ways of doing that.
Sure. So can you speak to the common intuition of that during the earlier stages of life in childhood, that is the time where you like what the environmental impacts such as parental influence or, you know, getting your kids to increase their cognitive ability, does it have the most pronounced effect then, and then later in adulthood have like a relative diminished effect?
Yeah, the evidence from twin studies, so, you know, you're comparing identical and fraternal twins, and you're looking at and from that you can get three quantities. You can get the amount of the heritability of a trait, so the amount of the variation in the trait that's correlated with genetic variation. And you can get the shared environment, so the all the stuff in the environment that makes the kids more similar together, and that includes parenting and stuff that they both experience, both twins experience. And you can get the non-shared environment, which is like the unique experiences that kids have, and also just loads of random like developmental noise and developmental stuff that happens that we can't really predict or model very well because it's kind of random, stochastic. So from that you can, and people have looked at, you know, the influence on education and on IQ tests and a whole bunch of other traits as well, over time. And it looks like the, you know, parental effects are much more pronounced earlier in the lifespan. It's not necessarily the case that these last forever. So, you know, even though they might have an effect earlier in the lifespan, they kind of wash out, it's been called, or fade out as time goes on. But certainly that's the case for IQ performance. It doesn't look like the parental effects are so big on that. But for educational attainment, there really does seem to be a lasting parental influence, and it's much more than people think.
Interesting.
There's a kind of interesting debate over like, well, the parental influence seems to be quite small on lots of psychological traits, but not education. And so why would that be? And so there's lots of different reasons why that is, about, you know, parental expectations and, you know, parental access to things and a whole bunch of other things. So that seems to be an exception to the general rule that parenting effects are quite small.
So what percentage of the variance on that?
Yeah, I mean,
sorry to just ask that question. Like, you just
I mean, it depends, but it's like, yeah, it's like much, it's a much larger proportion. I don't know, 10-15% or something like that.
Oh, that's quite substantial much, for environmental.
Maybe even larger than that. And that's shown across lots of different twin studies. I mean, there's still a debate over exactly what that means.
Sure.
But it converges with evidence from these newer types of study as well, where you're using DNA, where you're using actual genetic variants. And there's this whole phenomenon called genetic nurture, which is the idea that, I mean, I don't know if you were intending on getting into polygenic scores and
yes,
and all that.
That's my next. Yeah.
Well, do you know what? Let's talk about them first, because I think you have to know what they are before I can explain genetic nurture.
I think there are definitely some terms there that would be helpful to sort of lay out first. So yeah, I think you sort of already alluded to it. So what are we talking about when we say a trait is heritable? Because I think that's definitely commonly misunderstood.
Yeah, I think people, there's endless misunderstandings about heritability, what it means, and how to interpret it. So all it means is that variation in a trait, whether it's height or whether it's IQ, whether it's BMI, whether it's your propensity for a psychiatric disorder, like whatever it is, all it means is that people's differences in that particular sample that you've looked at are related to how much, you know, people's differences on that trait are related to how much they differ genetically. That's as simple as that. And it's just related. It's not even necessarily caused. When you do a twin study, you can get this. When you do a family study with all different family relatives, you can get a similar thing. And you can also nowadays get this quantity from looking at DNA rather than family relatives. You can look at unrelated people. Of course, we're all related to some degree, but you can look at people who are not in the same families and use DNA. So all it means is that, you know, the genetic differences are correlated with the trait differences to some extent. It doesn't mean, and there's loads of things it doesn't mean.
Yeah.
The main thing that it doesn't mean, which people kind of misinterpret, the main thing that it doesn't mean is that it doesn't mean that somehow that's that trait is then like locked in place, never to be changed. It's genetic, therefore you're never going to be able to do anything about it and change it. We've already talked about the impact of education on IQ. We know that IQ is heritable, and yet education changes it. So like there's no contradiction there, but people think there is a contradiction, because when they hear heritability, they often think, well, that means it's set in stone then. I mean, the classic example that people give is glasses, right? So myopia, short-sightedness, is very heritable, strongly heritable. That is, the differences in people in whether, you know, how short-sighted they are related to their genetics. But guess what? You can have an instant relief of your myopia by putting on a pair of glasses. An environmental intervention can come in and change your myopia instantly. So I now am effectively not myopic. I mean, you know, when I'm wearing my glasses. Because of an environmental intervention. So there's no actual contradiction. The other one people talk about is height, right? People have got taller over time. You go to museums and you see all those tiny suits of armor
from
people who used to be really short, like in the Middle Ages and so on. And it's not like we've you know, our genetics have changed that much over the past few hundred years. It's that the environment has gotten much better. Nutrition's much better. Healthcare is much better, and so on. And so people grow to taller height. That's one of the best examples of, like, you know, the classic thing about South Korea and North Korea. These are not very genetically different people at all. But I can't remember exactly how many inches difference it is, but on average the kids are much shorter where they're more badly nourished in North Korea. So heritability does not in any way imply immutability or a lack of ability to change things. And I think that's what freaks people out about heritability, is that they think that that's what it means. And this is a misunderstanding that is made by lots of scientists and made by lots of people who are fans of heritability as well. It's not like it's something that only the public or whatever misunderstand. Scientists don't get this either.
Yeah, I was going to say that heritability is variable as well. Is that the case? So there's a finding that heritability increases as over the course of your lifespan, or the heritability of a trait, or like you sort of grow into your genetics.
Some traits it goes the opposite direction, and some traits it doesn't. But for intelligence, heritability does seem to increase across lifespan. So that is, if you run the same, you know, twin study or whatever of older folks, compared to younger folks, you get a higher heritability score. So it's like you're more of the variation is due to your genetics. And again, there's, you know, there's an interesting debate over why that might be. Yeah. Heritability also changes depending on the situation, right? So you can imagine if you take it to the extreme, you can imagine an environment where everyone is exactly the same, right? So everyone is fed exactly the same food from when they're born. Everyone is given like the exact same like robot carers and robot friends and robot teachers that give them exactly identical experiences from life, like thought experiment. What would be the only thing that, you know, would differ there? It would be their genetics, right? It would be, and also, you know, any kind of random developmental things that happen. But you would get a much larger heritability in that world than you would in a world where people get variable environmental experiences. Some people encounter, you know, really good teachers, really bad teachers, friends that lead them down one path compared to another, parents that do one thing versus another. Some people are, you know, deprived or neglected as kids. And by the way, I should say all the stuff about genetics I've been talking about so far is for people who are kind of in the normal range, right? I mean, obviously the genetic effects, and, you know, this is relevant to this point, the genetic effects are going to be less important for people who are, you know, neglected or abused as kids, or, you know, some kind of real serious environmental
extreme trauma, environmental impacts.
Then the environment really is really going to kick in and have a huge effect, much more than it already does. So you know, all these twin studies are generally like of people who have come in to do the twin study, right? So they're generally people who are less socioeconomically deprived and so on. Like the biases we have in all psychology studies, where people who come in are like not a perfect representative sample of the population.
Right. So perhaps what's happening here is, as if environments are largely controlled by genetics or predictive of genetics, then over time people are like selecting environments to which they have genetic propensities to do so. And the more time you have, the more you select environments similar to your genetic propensities, and then heritability thus increases.
There's loads of interesting theories about that, what you've just described there is it could be described two different ways. People talk about gene environment correlation, that is, people kind of sort themselves into environments where their genes, you know, are you know, more suited given their genetic propensities to different stuff. So you start to see a correlation between genes and environments for that reason. And then there's this whole thing about like niche construction, like people get into a niche and then kind of build their environment around themselves in different ways. So like people who are smart going to university, building a niche there and making their environment more like, you know, the environment that we consider to be like the environment of a smart person or whatever. So there's all sorts, and this is you can investigate this to some degree using twin studies looking at gene environment correlation. There are all these kind of dynamics. There's gene environment correlation, the gene environment interaction, which is kind of the idea that some aspect of the environment might enhance or hold back your genetic propensities to certain things. And again, there's a debate over the extent to which that happens in reality. In theory, what I was just talking about there with the world where there's no environmental influences and only genetics, it's kind of the extreme version of a gene by environment interaction, such that, you know, people who are in a really stable environment might have more of an effect of their genetics, and this has been suggested by some studies, whereas people who are in much more variable and possibly damaging environments have a lower effect of their genetics. And there is some evidence for that from some countries, debated over which countries it happens in, and the evidence is a bit sparse, and so it's difficult to, you know, draw a really strong conclusion on that. But that's where people are doing, you know, all this research on twins and so on, to really try and pin down the interplay between genetics and environment in this way.
So where do polygenic scores fit into all of this?
Well, you know, as I was saying, the twin study is the classic way that's been used for like, you know, over 100 years to greater or lesser extent to understand the genetic influences on traits. But in more recent years, we've also been able to take DNA samples from people, and we've been able to measure many hundreds of thousands of DNA variants that they have all at once, you know, just using a saliva test or a blood test. We have these little chips now that we can run the DNA through, and it will give you, you know, every person's genotype different genotyping chips measure different numbers of genetic variants, but we're talking, you know, in some cases hundreds of thousands of genetic variants that you can measure all at once, so that people differ on. So we have these genetic variants called SNPs, SNPs, so single nucleotide polymorphisms, where you know, one person might have an A and the other person might have a C, and that's related to some change in their phenotype, some difference in their phenotype. Maybe they're, you know, they're slightly taller, slightly shorter, depending on which one of these they have. And we're talking very, very, very small effects. Each one of these SNPs has a tiny, 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 tiny effect. For a while, the whole field of behavior genetics and so on was really kind of misled by this idea of candidate genes, where we'd have this, you know, this one gene that would have really substantial effect on something like intelligence or depression or whatever it is.
One gene.
Or a handful of genes. You know,
that'd
small
be amazing.
Number,
a one number. Gene for intelligence.
But this is where you get in the press, you get people talking about like the gene for intelligence, for height, whatever. And it's because people thought for a long time that genes had large effects, and they kind of actually, it's a remarkably like depressing story of scientists kind of building up a whole edifice, all these scientific papers published based on this wrong assumption about candidate genes, and just none of them failed to replicate when they got larger samples. All of them failed to replicate when they got larger samples. None of them replicated when they got larger samples. Apart from like, there's about one, I would say, for IQ or for cognitive stuff, which is the ApoE gene, which does have a large effect. It's the one that's really strongly related to Alzheimer's disease. If you've got that gene, you're kind of double the risk of Alzheimer's disease. If you have two copies of it, something like 10 times the risk. And that's a fairly straightforward candidate gene that really does seem to have an effect, especially on cognitive stuff. But the other ones just did not replicate. It was a statistical mirage, the whole thing. So what we're doing now is we're looking at these SNPs. We're looking at these very, very small differences between people, and they are much more reliably related to traits. That they're, you know, again, whatever trait you're looking at, you can look at these SNPs in relation to you know, things like height or whatever, but also to intelligence, education, whatever it is. And so this is in the context of a genome-wide association study. That's what the study GWAS, you often see the name. And so what you do there is you're adding up all the genetic variants that have an effect, and you're seeing which ones on which parts, which chromosomes have the largest effects on whatever trait you're looking at. And once you've done a genome-wide association study, you can then look at another sample that was not involved in that first study. So you collect a whole new sample of people, and you say, how many of these SNPs, genetic variants, does this person have that we know are related to intelligence to some extent? How many does this person have? How many does this person have? I'm simplifying it to some extent, but this is basically what they're doing when you're making a polygenic score. And you just rate people for how many of those SNPs they have for some particular trait, particular outcome. And then you can use that rating, that polygenic score, to predict stuff about them, about in their life. You can use that polygenic score to predict, you know, their own score on a test, and it does correlate to some extent. So that's one, you know, way of replicating the results from the genome-wide association study and finding that they are not just nonsense variation, that they do actually predict out of sample. Like you have a whole independent sample, and you can predict using this polygenic score. Now, the best polygenic score for something like intelligence or educational ability only explains something like 14% of the variance or something. It's a very small amount at the moment, right? Because the genome-wide association studies are slowly kind of building up over time, and it turns out you need absolutely enormous samples to really get a good handle on this. So
of course, there's like a max number that it can explain, right? So like the extent to which a trait is heritable, that would be your limits to how a polygenic score can explain it. So intelligence, what we think is around 50% heritable. Or is it like foot?
Well, I mean, as you've said, it's differently heritable at different points in the lifespan, right? So it depends on when you're looking at it. But
right.
Yeah, you'd expect a kind of upper limit of 40-50% or something like that. But you know, the polygenic scores are only measuring some small portion of those SNPs. And there are lots of other genetic variants out there, including much rarer mutations that are not measured in the standard genome-wide association study. Mm-hmm. So over time, we'll get better at measuring those. And it looks like, you know, over time, you know, the polygenic prediction has got better and better and better. And it will, but as you say, it will max out at a certain point where there aren't any more genetic variations to explain.
I take it polygenic scores are better at predicting more simple traits like height and as opposed to complex tumor type.
Yeah, they are. They're much better. I can't remember what the most recent height prediction is, but yeah, like well into, you know, double figures, maybe 20-30% of the variation. I mean, I think I can't remember the exact numbers, but yeah, much, much better for things like height. I should say at this point, I think all genome-wide association studies should be understood that the vast majority of genome-wide association studies performed to date have been in people of a white European background. Turns out that if you try and predict in people of other backgrounds, the polygenic scores do much worse. They're not very good at predicting into people with other kind of broad genetic backgrounds. Only now are we starting to get genome-wide association studies in, there's large ones happening in various parts of Asia and in Africa too, to look at, you know, these SNPs in different in people of different backgrounds. That's the kind of big weakness so far of the polygenic scores, is that they're restricted to the people that you do the original data collection in. And in most cases, that's been white people, basically.
So, well, given perhaps the possible limitations of polygenic scores, would you like warn against potential applications for them? Because of genetic screening is often something that's proposed, because obviously if you have a percentage of variation that can be explained by a polygenic score and you can screen for these things before birth, then I guess you have the issue of people, well, trying to select which children they want for a desirable characteristic. So, yeah.
It's funny how people this comes up, because if you look back at philosophy or bioethics, ethicists in philosophy departments, ethicists in philosophy departments have been talking about this for decades, right? They've been saying at some point we will be able to predict. If you look at someone like Julian Savulescu or Peter Singer, really famous philosophers and ethicists have been talking about this for a long time and saying, you know, at some point in the future, we will be able to predict whether someone will get X disease. Should we select on the basis of different embryos? Should we select the embryos that are less likely to get that disease? And I think the sort of, you know, the intuition that most people have is that if it's a really bad disease that will like shorten their lifespan to a massive extent, then yes, we do. And the NHS does that already, right? We test for severe diseases, and somewhat over 90% of people choose to avoid those. So that's, you know, that's the one extreme end. And then like we kind of blur across to traits that are not essential or not life threatening in any way or anything like that, but they are things which might improve your life to some extent. Or do we choose them? And if I think people like Julian Savulescu, who I think is at Oxford, right?
He is.
I think his argument is that, yes, we should select for these things. Other philosophers disagree, and other biologists have come in. Now that we actually have got the technology, which is kind of leaning towards that direction, it's not, you know, we haven't got the technology right now, but it's now, you know, plausible that this could be tried. Biologists have come in and said, well, just, you know, take it easy, because there could be all sorts of different consequences that we just don't know, like unintended consequences of this. We don't know what it would be like if we selected on the basis of these traits. We don't know what the downsides could be. We don't know what the downsides for society, or indeed the person's actual own biology, could be. So there's all sorts of reasons to just take it easy with this stuff. I suspect that people are going to start using this, and it would be useful if, I've said this a few times, but it would be useful if the debate over like the genetics of traits and the genetics of things like intelligence and so on, we'd kind of move on to this point rather than us having to debate whether traits are heritable in the first place, because that's what that's how far you get mostly when you see stuff in the media. It's like, well, are traits even heritable? Like, what does it even mean? It's like, well, we've kind of been through this.
Yeah.
There's a much more urgent debate happening right now, which is like, what should we be doing with this information? To what extent can we use it? You know, what's the consensus of biologists on what would happen if we did this? And I don't want, like, you know, I don't want to make any strong arguments because I don't have any particularly strong opinions on this. Like, I think it's a, think it's an interesting, like, ethical, moral debate to be had. I would say, like, right now we need to be extremely careful about it, and because the technology is really very much in its infancy, and I wouldn't be strongly advocating in any way for it. But I think, you know, there will come a point where this is a debate we'll need to have in society. And it's really, it's just very strange to see people, you know, bringing this up as if it hadn't been discussed for decades by ethicists, you know, and just ignoring all that. And we just, it's almost like we have complete amnesia for all that stuff. And we just start the debate again. Happens for loads of things in society, I guess, like the debate comes up again and we start having it from scratch. But there is a basis, if you read into, you know, ethics about this, there is a basis to at least begin the argument.
So in terms, you did talk about possible negative effects if we screen for something like intelligence, right? I think because of the nature of it being a complex trait and there being so many SNPs that sort of group together, then I guess arguably if you have some sort of systematic bias for those collection of genes, then there may be some issue. Is that sort of like the apprehension, just the unknown of that?
Yeah, that's one possibility. I mean, you also need to go back to the original genome-wide association study and, like, what is it actually, you know, how good was the measurement being made there, and what actually have we measured, and have we picked up only intelligence or have we picked up something else? Sure. And there's all these questions. The polygenic score is not some perfect index of a genetic, a causal genetic variant that definitely causes you to have high intelligence. There's lots of other things that are sort of confounded with that in a polygenic score, including aspects of where people are from, and so this whole issue of population stratification, they call it, which is difficult to control for in studies. I think there's just so many unknowns, and the actual technology of doing it, and, you know, how big an effect would you get? Would it even be worth doing this? I think people's intuitions differ on different things, and a lot of people, I see kind of weird contradictions between what people believe. So, like, people are very strongly in favor of abortion, for instance, in most liberal cases. I would count myself in that, so not in favor of abortion, but in favor of the choice. Right?
I get you.
Of the choice. And yet, when they see this, which is, you know, there's a similar question. There's a similar ethical question of you're destroying embryos and so on. They freak out about this, you know. And so I think it's just because this technology is newer. But people also have kind of, I think there are contradictory stances, which it would be nice to see someone like work through at some point in a formal.
Some moral psychologists should be on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of moral stuff to be worked out here. And, you know, I don't want to take a strong position on it, but we are getting to the point where it would be useful to talk about this rather than just, you know, shutting it down and saying, I don't even want to talk about this. This is eugenics. I'm offended by it. Because, of course, some people do that with abortion, right? Some people say abortion, is the same thing. It's the same argument that's made by anti-abortion campaigners. And so we need to explain why this is different, if indeed it is. And so, again, I'm really not like trying to advocate for this or be pro it in any way. I'm just saying that this is a debate that we should be having, and not just for intelligence. Like, should we do this for cardiovascular disease? The predictor for cardiovascular disease is pretty good. Or should we wait till people, to do lifestyle interventions? I mean, it's not just about selection of embryos or anything. I mean, polygenic scores could be useful potentially. And again, there's a huge debate over this, and please don't, you know, assume that me saying this means that this is like a scientific consensus or anything. There's an enormous debate over the ethics and the practicalities of this. But they could be used in like doctors could say, well, you're in the top 1% of risk for cardiovascular disease, so, you know, maybe you should change your lifestyle in XYZ ways.
Sure.
So, you know, I think it's probably much less likely that stuff like that could happen in education for polygenic scores for education and intelligence and so on. But this is a, you know, this is a kind of active debate that's being had right now. And I think it's useful to have this debate now because, you know, the GWAS studies are getting ever bigger. The number of SNPs we understand is getting larger. The number of limitations and so on is getting larger. So the science is advancing. Yeah. And we should keep our ethics up to date with that.
Yeah, I like the point you made about like the potential value polygenic scores could have, right? So if you are told, because if you're told a percentile based on your genes and you're like in the top 1% of risk or something, then of course this isn't deterministic like we discussed, but one not can at all. Take actions to mitigate the chances of these things. So I didn't, like, I guess there is a theoretical argument to be made here that if you, the more information people know about their genes, the better they can sort of select their environment in accordance to their goals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one argument. I mean, the just to be devil's advocate, the argument against that is that, you know, this information is only available to certain people who can afford genetic sure. information. What are all the implications when insurance companies start finding this stuff out start charging people different insurance premiums for having different genetics? I mean, to some extent, they do that already, right? If you tell people they ask for your family history when you do sure. a life insurance application, so you're basically telling them that already. But they are interested in, you know, the applications of polygenic scores. I've had discussions with people who have, you know, in insurance companies who are interested in like how polygenic scores work, and the reason for that is that they want to try and include that in their kind of actuarial or other kind of insurance calculations, life insurance type calculations. There are lots of downsides. I mean, and also the other downside is like, for a lot of this stuff about like new exciting technologies, the life advice is usually don't eat so many calories, exercise more,
sure.
You know, live a healthy lifestyle, go out for a walk every so often. Like, and maybe you could give that advice whether or not you knew.
Yeah.
So like,
it's not clear what extra information one could get based on.
Right.
The,
right. Yeah. And and then the other side, the pro polygenic score side might say, well, for things like cardiovascular disease or whatever, you might be able to develop drugs on the basis of people's, you know, there might be drug targets that we learn about in these, you know, different genetics. So if we have a better understanding of the genetics related to stuff like heart disease or whatever, then it's possible that we can design better drugs in the future. But I think that's quite far off. But there are people talking about that. And also for psychiatric disorders as well, people are talking about that, but this is really like far in the future stuff, and doesn't necessarily rely on polygenic scores or anything. It relies on these GWAS studies to tell us accurate information about which genes are causally involved, and that involves a lot of very careful research.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think perhaps a philosophical question that I'd be interested to know your opinion on is, like, how do you feel about merit in all of these things, right? So it's clear that any sort of trait, intelligence, for example, so largely heritable, which is not a merit, something people will talk about as something that deserves any merit to your genetics. But then again, your environment, a lot of these environmental impacts correlate to intelligence, some cause intelligence to a certain extent. So like, how do you reward, like, do you feel like there can be a moral sort of normative way of rewarding people for any sort of like achievement, like educational attainment, with all these sort of genetics or environmental influences? Or have you thought about this at all?
It's an extremely, extremely good and extremely difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
It's like the number one question of like, why are we the way we are? And it's because of stuff that we don't control, right? And all the classic arguments that, it relates to all the classic arguments about free will, about like, why sure. why do you do something? It's because of, to a great extent, it's because of the way you are and the way your brain is set up. And, you know, were you the cause of that? Well, no, you weren't. And were your parents the cause of that? Well, no, not ultimately, because they were caused by their own.
Yeah.
Like, it goes back through every generation. This is the, I think, the Galen Strawson argument against free will, but how do you say that anyone deserves praise or blame for anything,
sure.
anything they do? And so that relates to this question of, you know, how do we reward in society different genetic endowments, and we do just to a great extent, right? people who end up healthier, for instance, not even talking about intelligence, people who just through sheer luck of health, maybe because they have a particular set of genes that make them give them a particular disease, they earn less money, right? They'll be less likely to get a job in our society. They'll be less likely to be able to succeed in whatever way you want to describe that. Isn't that unfair? And so you go back to the kind of that extends to intelligence, right? You didn't make your own intelligence. You didn't make your own genes. You didn't make your own environment that's caused you to be the way you are. So do you deserve the fruits of your success in that way? And I think one argument to that is the John Rawls veil of ignorance thing, that we should set up society in such a way that people would be treated, you would be treated in such a way that if you didn't know how you were going to turn out, if you didn't know how society was going to turn out, that you would want yourself to be treated. That's one way of doing it. And there's an interesting debate that was started off by the behavior geneticist Eric Turkheimer, and has been carried on by several people, but also by there's a book coming out soon by Paige Harden. That's next year, I think, probably that's going to come out, which is about, can you reconcile all this stuff about genetics with what they have, which is liberal politics? I mean, it's generally assumed that people who are happy with the way things work in terms of genetics and so on are from a sort of conservative political background. But can you make this work with liberal politics? So Eric Turkheimer calls it the hereditarian left. Like, can you have a hereditarian left where you accept that there are genetic differences between people, but you also have liberal politics? And I'd recommend people go and have a look at that, because that's an interesting perspective that you don't often hear talked about when this debate comes up. And I think Paige's book will be extremely helpful in that respect. And of course, there are lots of other philosophies of ways of thinking about how society should be set up to make sure that everyone is given a good chance. It goes back to that education, no matter what their ability is, everyone deserves the same amount of support. I think there's an enormous debate to be had there, and I think this is something which are going to hear much more of when Paige Harden's book appears next year, because I think that's going to be really enlightening for a lot of folk.
Definitely. So I guess, like, adding on to that, like, if you do try and sort of make the environmental factors today equal, right? So that's a lot of a push to do that from the left, especially. Socioeconomic status is often talked about as something as like cause of a lot of inequality, and depending on your socioeconomic status, you can have differential effects on stuff like educational attainment. But obviously, if you equalize this, then in turn, all you're doing is increasing the extent of the traits to which a trait is heritable, right? Because if there's two things, environment and genetics, then you're just making where you end up in life more due to genetics. And arguably, that's not necessarily of merit either, right?
Yeah, I think it's something that people are surprised by when they first hear it. But then when they think about it, it's like, well, that's kind of logically the only way it could be. And I mean, I think Robert Plowman has called this to this kind of theoretical extent. I mean, it's difficult to measure in different contexts practically, but theoretically you could think of heritability as like an index of equality. That is, like, if heritability is really high, it implies that the environment is pretty equal between people, and so they can differ to the extent that their genes differ. That's something that that people will I think instinctively react quite badly when they first hear it, but it can only be that way. Sure. But I think what we're talking about generally here, right, is what we're talking about is differences between people.
Yeah,
and I wonder if talking about differences between people is really the best, most interesting thing. It's interesting in terms of understanding what makes people the way they are and predicting people's paths in life and all that. Sure. Stuff. I think that's from a scientific perspective, it's very interesting. Yeah. But from a political perspective, I just wonder if the most important thing we have facing us right now is getting people out of being an objectively, poverty-stricken situation, right? Less interested in like making everyone, sure. moving everyone to an equal situation. I sort of feel like we should be focusing on raising people out of poverty in the most effective ways possible, all across the world. And we know ways of doing that effectively. We're just not spending our money effectively in many ways, in the way that it could be most effectively directed to alleviate poverty, alleviate disease, alleviate like things that are, we just know are objectively really bad for people right now. Sure. And so, I wonder if, you know, focusing too much on like, what are the differences between people and how much of the differences is kind of distracting us from the fact that like there's an urgent need to alleviate poverty in across the world, not just in our country, but in other countries. That would be maybe the thing we're focusing on. And at that point, like all the stuff about desert and intelligence and, sure. you know, genetics and stuff kind of isn't really that important.
No, I completely agree with you on that. So would you make like the normative claim that if we sort of make an environment that better facilitates people having the potential to reach their genetic limits or genetic potential, like this is the best thing we should be doing? Because there are definitely effects where, I think what's the scar-row interaction, where by virtue of a low socioeconomic status, people with very high genetic propensities for desirable traits, such as intelligence, for example, don't reach those potentials because of their environment do not facilitate those genetic propensities, right?
Yeah, and that was, you know, I kind of alluded to that earlier on where I said, you know, in some countries that does seem to be the case, in others not, and there's meta-analyses on that show that it's, okay. that effect doesn't occur everywhere. But the interesting thing is it might not occur in countries that are more equal, that are more, that have less wide disparities in, for instance, like, you know, it does seem to occur in Europe where it doesn't seem to occur in Europe. So you don't get this interaction where you do get it in the US, in at least in some contexts in the US. And we know that there are much bigger gaps between like a good school and a bad school in the US than say in the UK, where a good school and a bad school, okay, there are places that are sure. getting loads of resources to re-rich, but the gap is not as dramatic as it can be in some really poor places in America where, you know, my goodness, some of the schools are really falling apart and really very badly underfunded. So that was one of the arguments that was given in this paper for why you do see this effect in the US and not elsewhere. And there have been some other papers since then that don't find this effect even in the US. So I'm really confused as to whether this the scar row interaction
exists.
You know, is there in the like how we should understand it. But again, like logically, it should happen because all that is a restatement of this thing about if you equalize the environment, the heritability will
sure.
So, you know, it again tells us the difference between like theory and reality and the extent to which we can measure stuff versus, you know, the extent to which we would predict it on the basis of our theoretical understanding. And so, you know, I think the I don't know if I want to make any sort of normative claims or anything, but I think if we get to a situation where everyone is able to get the education that they need to reach their potential, I think that sounds like a pretty good idea in theory, at least. I don't go down the line of like, we should personalize the school experience for every single kid because every kid is so different genetically. And I think there's probably a lot of stuff we can do just teaching everyone better and more effectively, you know, the basic skills and so on. I'm not like, I think personalized education is to the extent to which I've seen it evaluated and looked at and talked to kind of people who study teaching and teachers, I kind of get the impression that that's less of a thing rather than just like more effectively doing the teaching that we tend to do. And again, that is outside of the world of, you know, in intelligence and stuff. It's probably the case, unless you believe in the kind of myth of learning styles and all that, it's probably the case that people learn in pretty similar ways. It's just that some are quicker than others, and you can probably improve the way that everyone learns by doing more effective teaching and more effective kind of psychological ways of making people learn stuff. And there's all sorts of cognitive psychology experiments that show about like the ways that you should set up tests and the way that you should set up retrievals and different, you know, memory techniques and so on that can help kids learn more effectively. And so, you know, again, that's outside of the world of intelligence stuff. I think that probably will affect most people of all different ability levels. So, you know, the extent to which all this intelligence stuff, you know, it's interesting for you and I to chat about, and it's interesting for scientists to look at and so on. But the extent to which it matters right now in the real world for improving kids' education, like we know lots of ways to improve kids' education that doesn't involve like selecting them all on intelligence tests or doing anything with intelligence tests, let alone doing anything with genetics. And I feel like those are probably the things we should be focusing on right now.
Yes. Okay. I'm glad you said that, because on the topic of reform, so what interventions, educational or otherwise, do you want to be implemented, like based on perhaps your knowledge on the factors leading to variance in educational attainment?
Well, look, I'm not a policy person or anything like that. So. I don't know what is plausible in a you know, in a practical context.
Yeah, but perhaps in a theoretical one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, theoretically, we know from our intelligence meta-analysis that staying in school for longer, as we discussed, you know, right at the start, staying in school for longer seems to make people smarter. There's a lot more research to be done on exactly why that is. But certainly I would ensure that people had, you know, opportunities to stay in school for as long as they want, and they weren't feeling any pressure. Playing devil's advocate, the other side of that is the argument that people like the economist Brian Kaplan has made. Have you seen his book? And it's called The Case Against Education. And he broadly argues that, and this is, it's kind of in a US context much more, he argues that the amount that people spend on university is not worth it compared to the benefits that it gives them. I would you know, want there to be a situation where people were getting some value out of their education, and if it's improving their, if we can optimize education for making people smarter in ways that will benefit them in their everyday life and in their careers and so on, then that's the best scenario. But we're only going to do that by you know, doing proper, like, clear-eyed education research on this kind of topic, and knowing what will be the optimal teaching methods, the optimal mixes of different ability levels. You know, at the moment, people get streamed into different ability levels. Is that the best way to do things? I'm not sure that a lot of the research on that is super rigorous. And we can learn a great deal from doing, you know, proper large scale rigorous research on these questions. So I think I don't want to make any policy prescriptions, because I'm just not a policy person, but I definitely understanding this stuff about intelligence is important. But also, there's a great deal of understanding about the actual, like, ways that we teach kids to improve their retention of facts and retention of skills and so on. And a lot of that, as I say, can happen across different ability levels. So, you know, we've not had a great few years in psychology of, like, the replication crisis and all that.
Mm-hmm. Don't remind us.
Yeah. but there are some things which seem fairly solid in psychology, and a lot of that memory stuff and retention stuff is seems to be fairly solid. So I'm kind of pro those kind of interventions more than anything about, like, restructuring the system to bring back selective education or anything along those lines.
Right. That's very fair. Well, thank you. And I want to be respectful of your time here, but is there any place you'd like to send listeners to perhaps learn more about your work on genetics or intelligence, or to engage with you perhaps on social media?
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm on Twitter at Stuart J. Ritchie. You can send me a tweet, about this topic. I wrote a book about this. My first book was Intelligence. It's part of this series of books, kind of introductory books called All That Matters. So it's called Intelligence, All That Matters, which is a bit unfortunate, given that I don't think that intelligence is all that matters.
But
everyone asked that question about the title of the book. But it's part of the All That Matters series. So there's, like, Ancient Japan, All That Matters. You know,
interpreted it as All That Matters about intelligence, like an introduction.
Well, that is the correct interpretation. Yeah. But unfortunately, a lot of people have not interpreted it that way. So you can check that out. And that's a kind of now slightly, I mean, it's 5 years old, 6 years old now, depending, like, when I wrote it. So it's a bit out of date in terms of the genetics, I would say, because at that point, we were only just getting the very first genome-wide association studies of intelligence.
Sure, yeah.
So I would also recommend Ian Deary's book, the very short introduction to intelligence. Now, that originally came out in 2000, but last year he updated it, so there's a second edition, and it's now much more up to date. And that's the kind of book I would really recommend if you want to get the most up to date stuff on intelligence in a really short format. And in that book, and also in my book, you'll find references to, you know, textbooks and various other things, and also all the original papers, of course, that are published with these, all this data on intelligence that we're talking about.
A lot for the listeners to look up potentially.
Indeed. Oh yeah, I mean, this is one of the oldest areas of kind of psychology research, right? So there's 100 years of research. Definitely. To catch up on in this topic. And I think, you know, in the last few years, it's become much more exciting because we've got all this genetic stuff. You know, the extent to which this will change our world or our understanding of psychology is yet to be seen, but certainly there's a lot more technology around that we could use to kind of interrogate these questions, and it's been really fascinating to watch.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Project Psychology. If you'd like to find out more about what we do, like and follow us on Facebook at Oxford University Psychology Society, where you can also give your suggestions on which guests you'd like to see for future episodes of the podcast. Hope you can join me on the next episode of Project Psychology.